Morning, everybody. Can you all hear me? Great. My name is Stephen Kinsella. I'm from the University of Limerick, and I'm one of the organisers of the conference, but I'm more importantly today, the chair of the property market section. This is the national obsession, and we have some very, very interesting speakers. We're going to talk on a range of very relevant topics. First up, we have Ronan Lyons from Oxford University and Identify Consulting. He's going to be talking about a site value tax. Then we have Dr. Michelle Norris from UCD, and then Professor Rob Kitchen from NUI Maynooth. Talk should be 20 minutes or so, and then we'll try our best to leave room for comments. Thank you very much. First up is Ronan Lyons.
Thank you very much, Stephen. This is a presentation which is basically my aim to become the least popular person in Ireland by outlining what a property tax bill would be that you'd face. It's a question really, basically in brief, the proposal I have is that we would use the existing sources that are of information that are there to put in place an interim site value tax. This would generate, if it was applied to residential and commercial property, would generate about 3 billion in new revenue, 3 billion in revenue, of which about 1 billion would be new revenues, replacing commercial rates, stamp duties, windfall taxes, that kind of thing. In terms of the sort of the punchline, the average charge would be about €625 a household for this interim site value tax. But you've got to remember, when you're talking about a site value tax, the base isn't the household, the base is the acre or the hectare. So we should really be looking at what sort of acreage are we looking at, and we don't know exactly until the Department of Environment will be publishing some statistics on just how many acres or how many hectares of the country are zoned residential, and then we'll know the true base of the tax. And why am I suggesting this at a time when we already have an interim property tax in the form of a €100 household charge? Well, I think this is a much more fair and efficient placeholder with a view to implementing a full site value tax. And also, it's something that can stand the test of time for 3, 4, or 5 years, depending on the time it takes to implement the full site value tax. If a high enough rate is put in, you can actually lower VAT and lower income tax and still close the deficit somewhat. And also, this is something that should be thought of as part of really wider local government reform. That's a topic that's far broader than today. But really, if this is going to be a true site value tax, the money should go locally, and therefore should be funding local amenities and related to the spending powers of local authorities. The context briefly: property tax is a how rather than an if at this point, and that's a phrase I borrowed from Micheál Collins, who's done work in this area as well. And there's a commitment in the Programme for Government, the last Programme for Government before that, in the National Recovery Plan, and in various budgets. The type of tax, if it's ever mentioned, is a site value tax, but it's viewed as tricky to implement. So the Commission on Taxation said there's a sound economic rationale for considering a site value tax, but it would take a number of years to become established, and it would require cooperation between a number of public bodies. Therefore, we recommend that a site value tax should not be pursued at this stage. And personally, I think that's, it's realistic, perhaps realistic at the time, it's almost like an incredibly depressing view of policy making in Ireland. This is the best thing, we should definitely do this, but it looks a little bit difficult. And we're not good at cooperation, so I don't think we should try. And that's not to denigrate the work of the Commission on Taxation. I think that they were working within their own context. I think that today's presentation alone gets us 80% of the way there. And I think the 80-20 rule should apply on that. And so instead of having €100 per household, why not use the information that's there, get the bulk of the way there, and then worry about fiddling around at the margins after that. So for those who don't know, a site value tax is a tax that recurs every year on the value of a site. And that value is excluding the value of any improvements or properties or buildings or capital that's on that site. So if you have 120 square metres in 220 square metre plots beside each other, and one is a block of apartments and one is a three-bedroom home, they would face the same tax bill. And the idea is that it encourages the most efficient use of land. It's closely related to the rental value of the site. And if you think about it, what affects the land value or the rent that someone would pay for a plot of land. It's all about amenities and disamenities, public services, social capital. It's about market depth, access to jobs. These are all things that are created not by the individual who owns the land. They're created by society and the community that lives there. So this is a rent that's paid on the wealth that you accumulate through activities that you don't do, that society does. So in that sense, it's a very fair system. It's effectively a wealth tax. And when you think that 3/4 of all Irish wealth is in property, those who want a wealth tax should look first to taxing property. And this is the best way of taxing property, because if you tax the overall value of a property, including the building, you're actually punishing people for making their homes more energy efficient. You're punishing people for extending their house if they need to. You're punishing people for using efficient land. And the problem we have at the moment is the tax system punishes some of the things we want most. So development levies will be highest on plots of land that actually should be developed first, because they know that people are more likely to meet that threshold. Commercial rates are higher if the site is occupied. These are crazy aspects to the current taxation system. So we need something that's fairer, that encourages a more efficient use of land. So what I want to do today is outline the methodology and the data that I'm using to generate this interim site value tax, and then show some estimates of how it would work, and then outline how you might move to a full site value tax based on the information that we have, before outlining in brief some sort of fiscal outcomes from this. The principal contribution really is in the first two sections, rather than the second two, but I think the second two are clearly very important and natural to cover in the presentation. So the value of a property is really the value of the building and the value of the land. And if we know the cost or the value of a certain property type everywhere in the country, we can really calculate the value of the underlying land. So the method that I'm using is the hedonic price regression. It effectively breaks down the property into all its different attributes. So if you tell me what type of property is, you tell me how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms, and what census district it's in, I can get you pretty much 80% of the way there on what the value of that property is. So the regressions that I'm using, they control for different property attributes, in particular type and size. Size here is measured by bedrooms and bathrooms. So it is true to say that you could do an even better job, get above that sort of 75-80% explanation by including things like square meterage, a BER if every building had one, the age of the building. Those things would improve, but the bulk is done. What you can do with that is you can produce one average price per census district. And that average price is an average over 5 standardized property types. So a one-bedroom apartment, a two-bedroom terrace, a three-bedroom semi-detached, a four-bedroom bungalow, and a five-bedroom detached property. And you will say, well, hang on a sec, there aren't any one-bed apartments in this rural census district, there aren't any four-bed bungalows in that city centre district. But because you know the relationship between the different property types within regions, you can say, here's what a four-bed bungalow would be in this area, because we know the relationship between different property types. What you can also do is you can use that basket and weight it by how common one beds are, how common three beds are, and you can then therefore control for the fact that these vary in different census districts and get a like-for-like comparison across a basket of properties for each of the 4,500 districts. And the 4,500, for those who know their census districts, that's about 1,000 too many. And that's because I've been working with Justin and Rob in Maynooth, and we've broken down the cities into enumerator areas. So that gives us extra refinement within cities, which is very important, because land values vary most in terms of distance in cities rather than outside of cities. So the data that I'm using is the DAFT.ie data set. It's about 1.3 million ads that we know to townland level or better between 2006 and 2011. And that's across both sales and letting segments. And you'll see why I used the letting segment in a minute. Typically, there's a couple of questions that arise at this point about the data rather than about the tax. And the question would be, why don't you use ads for sites instead? Well, the ads for sites will have a bias, because what's an empty site now? It's one that hasn't been developed yet. Why hasn't it been developed yet? Probably because of distance from the city centre or the town centre. So you'll have a bias sample. Also, the informational infrastructure about sites is a lot poorer than it is about properties. We know types of properties, we know size of properties, as in bedrooms and bathrooms. With sites, you don't have that informational infrastructure there. Is it valid to use asking prices? I would say yes, when you've controlled adequately for the fact that this is asking prices and controlled for different market conditions. Because what you want out of an interim tax is the relativity, not necessarily the absolute level. The full tax will have to give you your absolute level. But the interim tax, you only need to know what the average is and where one particular region is relative to the average. And the third question is, well, if you're going to set up an interim site value tax, what are you saying are the site values currently in the country? And that's a very tricky question to answer, because if you use a different method, you'll get a different answer. But I try and give an answer to that the slide after next. The first thing I'd say is, just in terms of being able to control for asking prices, that these are asking prices. We know that there's a gap between asking prices and closing prices, and I see Ray here from the central bank. And this is work that I've been doing with the central bank, trying to calculate the gap on average between asking price and closing price. So this tells us that in the boom years, you have, you know, a 5% transaction price an asking price that's 5% below the transaction price. And now you have, once it crosses the line and goes sort of south, you see that the closing price is well below the asking price. You've got about a 10% discount. So these are things we can measure for. And if you to make the case that you don't think asking prices are a valid base on which to base this interim tax, you'd need to argue that one particular district or one bunch of districts are out of line, not just in the bust, but also at every stage from boom to bust. And I don't think that's plausible. I can't see how you justify that case, that some particular regions just consistently are out when it comes to asking prices relative to others, no matter what point you are in the economic cycle. In terms of site value estimates, hopefully that's not too small to read, but basically what I'm saying is that if you break the country down into 10 bands and put each census, each of these 4,500 districts into one of those 10 bands, you're talking about site values that vary from 20 to 30,000 at the bottom, up to maybe 2 million to 10 million at the top. Now, a natural reaction to this is, Ronan, they're pretty wide bands. Like 2 to 10 million is a bigger differential than between one band one and some other bands. That's a very fair point, and I think a full tax would need to control and understand exactly how site values vary. What I'm suggesting here is an interim tax. So the fact that these are vague estimates doesn't really hamper the exercise, because as long as the government knows approximately how much it wants to raise and approximately what the base is, either in number of households or number of acres, then you know what the average is going to be. And as soon as you know what the average is, all you need to know is the distance any particular district is from the average. What's the premium or the discount for being in one district relative to the average? And that's what this exercise can do. So I've also put in what a hypothetical 2% site value tax would be on two standardized property types. Property A is a two-bed terrace on 120 square meters. And property B is a four-bed detached on 500 square meters. And I've put the ones in italics where I don't think they're as relevant. So bands 1 to 5, roughly speaking, are urban areas where you're going to have smaller sites and smaller properties in terms of terraced. And bands 6 to 10 are more than not rural sites, and you're going to have larger properties and larger sites. And you can see that for a terraced property, you're talking about, you know, in the city centre of Dublin, you're talking about €1,200 on average for an interim site value tax. For the cheapest area, cheapest band of areas, a four-bed detached home on a plot of 500 square metres would be looking at a charge of about €50 a year. This is the actual map that I've been working with in the guise of Maynooth, and this places each of the districts into one of those 10 bands. And this is what I'm proposing. And I suppose maybe in an Excel format, would be used as the basis for an interim site value tax. And it's based on that average over those five property types, but with two models. The first is based on asking prices as they stood in late 2011. And the second model is based off the rental value as I mentioned, land is ultimately about the value of the services you get from it, which you can often measure most directly through the rental value. So I've used a 6% yield rule, so you get the annual rent over the course of the year, and that's 6% of what would be suggested as the value of the property. And this, because it's a 6% off a basket, it does hide differences that you might see in the market between a one-bed yield and a five-bed yield. Yields for one-beds now might be 9%, but yields for five-beds are still down around 3, 4%. What I've done in this exercise as well is I've assumed that the build cost is constant around the country. It's clear I'm not an architect. But you can vary that if you know how the price of property, the build cost of property, standardized property varies around the country. You can adjust the methodology for that. There's a zoom in on the cities, and you can see that Dublin is principally band 10, but with a bit of band 9 and band 8 in there. So it'll be in the top three bands, the greater Dublin area. Cork is mostly band sort of 7, 8, with some in 9 and 10. And then as you go into Galway, Limerick and Waterford, you're seeing cheaper and cheaper implied land values from what we see in the data set. So this is to show that this is something we can do, we have done, and the government can use straight away to generate an interim site value tax that's going to be an awful lot fairer than the 100 euro charge on households. I've picked Limerick and looked at sort of five standardised properties. There's a report that's available on the Smart Taxes website, but that goes in more detail through all these. And you can see that it goes from a Limerick one-bed in the Market city centre district through to a rural four-bed, and the different charges. And the thing that jumps out straight away is that the rural property has a huge charge relative to the properties here in Limerick in the city centre. And that's because of the site size for Limerick. To do the exercise for Dublin, because Dublin would be in bands 1 and 2, it'd be the rural urban gap wouldn't be as noticeable, but it is for this. And that, I think, gets to one of the heart of one of the issues around this, which is about what do we zone as residential and what's actually used by rural families in particular as residential. But I want to look at a couple of common concerns, because I know I'm running close to time here already. What about those who bought at the boom? Well, there's a number of ways you can get around that. You could you could give them grandfathered tax credits. So when the tax comes in, you could say, if you've paid 25,000 in stamp duty in 2005, we'll give you a certain amount of tax credits, but discounted by the fact that it was 2005. It's a long time ago, so you'll have a property tax bill, but you can use this to write it off for a certain period. Or if you don't like stamp duty as a measure for alleviating sort of people who bought the bubble, you could just do it by transactions rather than by the bill paid. So you could say, well, we want first-time buyers to get a discount because we think they would be hard done by this. First-time buyers from, say, 2004 to 2008. The point of this is that you can definitely adjust for this. This isn't a killer against this proposal. Likewise, elderly couples with no income, well, part of it is about use land efficiently. Maybe we shouldn't be subsidising them to live in land that imposes a cost on younger people. But that's not going to win me any votes, certainly not with grey power. So you can do things like have a lien on the property instead, so that when they die or when the property is sold, only then do you take your tax bill. Does it encourage overdevelopment? If you have that plot somewhere in the suburbs, will someone just knock the house and build a whole lot of apartments? Your local authority development plans and your guidelines are very important for that. Are people expected to live on no land? If you want to shift the burden to unoccupied residential sites, give people a per person green space allowance, again in the form of a tax credit. And does it not punish those on large rural sites? They don't enjoy public services, but they do enjoy very large sites, and that imposes a cost on those who don't live on large rural sites. If you think about a population of 4 million spread equally in 20 towns or 2,000 villages, it's much more efficient to live in 20 towns. So there is a cost that these people impose on the rest of society. We can certainly allow for that, but we need to know that we're basically allowing a particular interest group to pay less while the rest of us have to pay more. So briefly, moving to a full site value tax, how would this be done? The information is there. The Property Registration Authority runs the land registry. The only major gap, only major gap is Dublin, but the ordnance survey maps are there for Dublin, and most of those properties, it's between the canals, and most of those are actually commercial, for which we do know the owner anyway through the commercial rate system. The Property Services Regulatory Authority is going to have Revenue Commissioner's data as of June, certainly no later than June, on transactions. You've got Geodirectory, and you've got development, the Dev Plan GIS by the Department of the Environment. What you basically do is you have, and this is, geographers can do this in their sleep, you've got these maps, you overlay them, and you can connect up information on transactions, property characteristics, site size, and location. And you can do all that very, very easily. In terms of how complicated you want to make the system, distance to amenities matters. And even within those 4,500 zones, there's going to be variation in land values. So there's a whole range. This is actually getting close to my doctoral research, the valuation of these amenities. There's a whole range of things that you can include in this. I won't say easily, but certainly with a bit of work, it's not impossible to include these and to refine it. The trade-off is between simplicity and robustness and defensibility. I won't go through how the system is administered. I'll finish up with the fiscal context. As we all know, there's a huge deficit. About one third of public expenditure is unfunded. And in 2005, albeit these figures are skewed by capital spending, local government spent about half of all public money, but only raised about 3% of the revenues. And in most Anglo-Saxon countries, you're talking about up to 10% of tax revenues are generated through property taxes, and they're predominantly local. So as I said at the start, this would be something that even the interim one could generate significant new revenues. The medium-term fiscal statement says we need 4.65 billion in new revenues by 2015, and that organic growth will give about 1.4 billion of that. We could argue whether that's realistic, but leave that aside and say we need 3.3 billion, roughly, in new tax measures. So you could use this to replace rates, stamp duties, and the windfall tax. And it would, if it was done on commercial property as well, which is why you'd abolish rates, it would raise about 3 billion euro, about 1 billion of which would be new revenue streams, i.e. 2 billion is gone, but you're bringing in 3 billion. Can we not raise other taxes instead? This is going to be the most common concern, and I'll finish up on this. If you don't want a property tax, what you were saying is you want higher income tax and higher VAT. It's not, I don't want a property tax, I don't want any tax. That's not an option. We need to balance the books. So income tax affects competitiveness, and we already have some of the highest marginal rates in the world. Consumption tax is regressive, and it hits poorer households harder. And we already have, outside of the Nordic countries, the highest VAT rate in the world. So what you're saying is you want to make Ireland more regressive in its taxation system and less competitive internationally if you don't want a property tax. And that's the point I'll finish up on is, could you even make the case, I want to cut VAT and income tax and still close the deficit? I would argue that if you thought about a 10% site value tax, would bring in a lot more revenue, the bulk of which is new, even though you're replacing some ones that you're getting rid of. And you could use that, let's say, 7.5 billion with a 10% site value tax to cut income tax and cut VAT. And that might be an easier way to sell this. The people see their VAT rate going down, people see the income tax going down, because ultimately, property taxes ain't popular in Ireland. And this is my bid, as I say, to be the least popular man. So I'll finish up there, and I'll hand over to Michelle.
Just a slight moment of housekeeping. I think we'll keep the questions to the end, and that way we'll have a fuller discussion. So please, Dr. Michelle Norris from UCD.
Good morning, everybody. I'm from the School of Applied Social Science in UCD, so I'm not an economist, but thanks to my colleagues in the economics department for inviting me. I warned them in advance that my presentation would contain no equations, no regressions, and no modelling, but they left me in anyway. So my paper looks at the issue of mortgage arrears. I'm sure most of you are aware that this issue has grown in significance in recent years. But I'll just put some figures on it to give you a bit of background. The latest data from the central bank we have indicates that 8.1% of residential mortgages were in arrears at the end of the third quarter of 2011, and a further 4.7% had been restructured but weren't in arrears. and the level of mortgages in arrears has grown consistently since the start of the economic crisis in 2007-2008. So this has inspired a series of responses from government set out in a series of reports since 2007. So mainly the response to date has involved forbearance. So banks have been instructed by the central bank to come up with arrangements to park a certain amount of debt in the cases of people in arrears, not to repossess houses or start action for repossession of houses in cases of arrears for a period of moratorium on repossessions. And the forbearance arrangements have been extended and extended and extended since 2007. And currently the latest version allows forbearance to be put in place for up to 6 years. So households that can fund two-thirds of the mortgage interest can avoid having their dwelling repossessed for up to 6 years. As a result of these forbearance arrangements, the level of foreclosures on mortgages of repossessions of dwellings has remained very low in Ireland compared to the norm in countries such as the UK and the US that have had a significant housing bust. So in quarter three 2011, there were 162 dwellings repossessed. Now, the vast majority of these were voluntarily surrendered to the banks rather than the banks go and take legal action. There's also been a wider debate about the possibility for large-scale forgiveness of mortgage debt, forgiveness or write-off of mortgage debt, or even small-scale. To date, there's been no action in that regard. You'll notice my footnote, unless you're dealing with NAMA, but certainly for ordinary households. So my paper today looks at research I have recently conducted, which was commissioned by the Money Advice and Budgeting Service, which is a state-funded service which provides advice to people who are in financial difficulties and are over indebted, and also by the Citizens Information Board, which funds MABS. So it's based on a small scale but very in-depth study of 46 households, so 46 MABS households who are in arrears on their mortgage, so they're clients of MABS. And the research involved very in-depth interviews with these households for 2 to 3 hours. Also a review of their financial history, obviously with their permission, based on their files covering their dealings with MABS. We chose households from a range of MABS centres around the country. The list is there. And this is the first phase, we're hoping, of a longitudinal study where we'll visit these households on a regular basis, probably two more times, to look at their pathways through the mortgage arrears, over indebtedness process, and out the other end. Okay, so the objectives were to document their pathways into and out of mortgage arrears, examine their interaction with the systems of support, with the government, with mortgage lenders, examine the impact which their situation had on their own lives, their interpretation of the situation. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is the pathways into mortgage arrears of these households. Now, there is a lot of research on what leads to mortgage arrears internationally, particularly based on the crash in the United Kingdom in the early 90s. And all of it indicates that loss of employment, loss of self-employment, a radical fall in income is obviously a key cause. So this is the situation with the group we examined from MABS, and it's also the situation with MABS clients in general countrywide. In a smaller number of cases, there were other factors that drove people into arrears, most commonly relationship breakdown, etc. But this morning I wanted to highlight some of the experiences of these households that haven't been discussed in the public discussions of the mortgage arrears issues, what we found that was unusual. And one of the things I felt was worth highlighting was the role of multiple indebtedness, and particularly debts rolled up into mortgages, in driving households into arrears. So as you can see just from the small group of households we looked at, the vast majority of them had topped up their mortgages, or more commonly consolidated debts into mortgages, so rolled in their car loan, their credit card, etc., into mortgages. Practically all of them had unsecured debts on top of their mortgage, so in other words, debt not secured on their home. A minority of them also had buy-to-let mortgages or holiday homes. And one issue about examining MABS clients is that a very large cohort of MABS clients, when we started our research, were dealing with subprime lenders rather than the mainstream banks. So they were paying higher interest rates, dealing with subprime lending companies such as Start, Stepstone, etc. So in that case, I, from that perspective, I want to emphasise the MABS clients are not typical of all households in arrears in the country. So the vast majority of households in arrears in the country would have prime mortgages. Certainly now, maybe not at the start of the bust. Okay, so this issue about multiple debt, we also conducted group interviews and individual interviews with the MABS money advisors, who are the people who deal with the indebted households. And they also emphasised that for the vast majority of households, it was an issue of being in arrears on multiple sources of debt and also the rolling up of debt into their mortgage. So this is a quote from one of the money advisors we interviewed. What you find is that people have difficulty with their mortgage. They tend to have all borrowing, experience of borrowing in all areas. You know, they borrow for a car, a holiday, a credit card balance. So their practice would be to access credit for all times. And the MABS national data on their clients also supports that interpretation. So as I mentioned, we looked at people's own interpretations of their situation in a lot of depth. And I was quite struck by the fact that practically everyone we interviewed emphasised their own responsibility for their borrowing decisions. So this is a quote from somebody we interviewed in Tralee. The bottom line is we borrowed the money, we're responsible for it. We didn't have to take the money, we didn't have to buy the house. So everybody emphasised that they were responsible for their own situation in that regard, or they played a role in their own situation in that regard. However, all interviewees stressed the imbalance of responsibility between borrowers and lenders. So even though they emphasised their own poor borrowing decisions, their attitude was that they were, at the time of the research, which was 8 months ago, they were taking sole responsibility for the poor borrowing decisions, and the responsibility fell on the borrower rather than the household, certainly in their interpretation. One of the other things I was quite struck by was the lack of financial literacy of the people we interviewed, and the lack of problems in relation to the quality of advice they received from professional advisors, mortgage brokers, and also quite a few of the people we dealt with were self-employed and they would have had accountants. And all of them emphasised that they hadn't been warned of the full implications of their borrowing by their professional advisors, or in some cases they'd been advised to take on borrowing which was just unsustainable by their professional advisor. And we didn't come across a single case where households have been warned not to take on this debt by their, for instance, accountant. So here are just two quotes from some of the interviews we did that highlights this issue. First quotation, the next thing is I didn't have proper accounts because I didn't have an accountant. Conversations took place between the bank and the mortgage broker that I wasn't even aware of. They said they didn't need an accountant, they didn't need accounts. They just got a letter stating that things look good. That's what I got. I got a letter from an accountant who hadn't done my account, and then I got the mortgage approved. The second quotation is from a non-Irish national who had, it's not that obvious in the quotation, had quite poor English. And he talks about his experience of accessing a subprime mortgage and how the implications of borrowing from a subprime lender rather than a prime lender in terms of the interest rate he would pay and how it would be linked to the ECB rate weren't explained to him. So this was also very common. Now, as you would expect, and there's a lot of research on this, debt problems have very negative physical and mental health consequences for the households affected. So among the small cohort of 46 households we interviewed, for instance, there were two suicide attempts among that group, just to give you an idea. And here are some quotations from some of the interviews which highlight the negative mental health consequences of debt. "I don't sleep. I haven't slept for 18 months. It's a huge worry, and there's no doubt about it. You would worry about anything else, but the roof over your head is one thing everybody does worry about." Okay, so what was then people's experiences of interacting with the banks they were dealing with about their arrears and with the state supports that are there for people in mortgage arrears? Obviously, we spoke to people in a lot of depth about their experience of interaction with mortgage lenders. And there was quite strong evidence, and also this was supported by the interviews we did with MAB's money advisors, that certainly until recently, the experience of borrowers in arrears interacting with mortgage lenders has been quite negative. So, for instance, quite a lot of the people we dealt with who were borrowing from subprime lenders mentioned how they had to ring a call centre in Bangalore to discuss their mortgage arrears. And the person they were dealing with didn't speak English, good English, and the stress associated with that, etc. There was also lots of reports, certainly until recently, of very, very, very regular contact from banks and lenders with people in mortgage arrears. And certainly the people in mortgage arrears we interviewed argued that this constituted harassment. So here's a quote from a MABS client in Tralee. "My subprime lender was on the phone for 3 or 4 times a day, every few hours. The stress was getting unreal at that stage." The top quotation there from an interviewee from Arklow highlights how the prime lender just didn't return calls, didn't return correspondence when she was trying to contact them to renegotiate her debt, which again MABS money advisors highlighted was quite common until certainly the last year or two. So we did come across evidence that in experience of interaction with mortgage lenders has recently improved. So for instance, this money advisor we interviewed said initially subprime lenders were terrible, they wouldn't negotiate at all. Now there's no difference between the subprime and ordinary lenders, they're all glad to be getting anything. So MAB's money advisor said to us that as the mortgage arrears process has gone on, the banks required by the central bank to have a mortgage arrears resolution process have appointed specialist staff to deal with people in arrears, have come up with protocols, and that has meant that the experience of the borrowers who are dealing with them has improved. They have been appointed specific staff to deal with their case, and they've managed to get a more uniform experience, shall we put it that way. We did find, though, that there was still very significant problems related to the interaction of people in arrears with unsecured lenders, and also with debt management companies that unsecured lenders, such as credit card companies, had sold the debt onto. And we came across lots of examples of really behaviour that constituted harassment. So here's a quotation from an interviewee from Arklow. "I'll give you one example of a company that rang us 20 times in one day, and that was just a small amount, well, €5,000. It was a credit card company. You know, they were tormenting us every day for a week, and one guy used to ring me every morning at 8:10 when I was trying to get the kids out to school." So that was a very, very common experience of people in arrears, which obviously added to their stress. So people had quite negative experiences of dealing with lenders, and then they went to the Money Advice and Budgeting Service. Sometimes they went to a private debt advisory firm that are becoming more common, and then went to MABS. So we obviously asked them about their experience of dealing with the Money Advice and Budgeting Service. Now, the Money Advice and Budgeting Service provides a whole range of supports to people in arrears, including help with their budgeting, review of income and outgoings, etc. But we found from interviewees what they valued most was simply having somebody to listen to their story. And I was very struck by the fact that all the people we interviewed, we asked them, "Who have you told about your debt problems?" And nobody had told anyone except their spouse. And in one case where a house had actually been repossessed, the husband involved hadn't told his wife, who didn't know until the bailiffs showed up on the doorstep. So the shame of people's situation was very striking. So it was very liberating for people just to have somebody to talk to them. And they also found the fact that MABs negotiate on behalf of clients with lenders for debt restructuring very, very liberating. And they felt it was very valuable having a professional negotiating on their behalf rather than trying to do it themselves. Obviously, people in arrears are also eligible to get mortgage interest supplements, so to get the interest portion of their mortgage paid by the state. And we spoke to people about that, and we also spoke to community welfare officers who administer mortgage interest supplement. And we got the same story countrywide about this support. There were lots of complaints about inconsistent decisions. So one person with what MABS money advisor thought was a very similar situation to another client, one of these would be turned down and one of them would get mortgage interest supplement. Another issue about mortgage interest supplement, obviously, which isn't, I think, being discussed certainly in the media, is that mortgage interest supplement only covers loans taken out for the purchase or repair of a primary residence. So if you have rolled up debt into your mortgage, rolled up your car loan, rolled up your credit card into your mortgage, that portion of your mortgage interest will not be covered by mortgage interest supplement. Now, obviously, expenditure in mortgage interest supplement has increased dramatically in recent years, and I'm not proposing that the state should subsidise people's lifestyle debt. But it is worth pointing out that that stipulation firstly makes mortgage interest supplement very difficult to administer, because the community welfare officers would have to try unroll all the debt out of the mortgage to work out what proportion related to the dwelling. So that was very technically difficult for them. And it also meant that lots of households who got mortgage interest supplement ended up having to subsidise their mortgage from their dole payments, as most of them are on the dole, because the MIS didn't cover much of it. So here's a quotation from an interviewee in that situation with a family of three very small children, who explains how covering her mortgage, because there's rolled up debt in the mortgage, involves living on 3 weeks' dole payments and paying all her child benefit and her last week's dole payments into the mortgage account. Okay, in terms of pathways out, the people we interviewed were desperate for a solution to enable them to move on with their lives. Obviously, the solutions must reflect the nature of the problems. So it was a view of the money advisors we interviewed, and also based on the interviews we conducted with MABS clients, that the forbearance arrangements that have been put in place by the government to date are very useful in the case of people who are in short-term difficulty with their mortgage, or whose mortgages are even viable in the medium term. So for a significant minority of these people, forbearance arrangements did sort out their situation. So just to give you two examples, this is a farmer we interviewed from Galway who talked about how he feels he can work his way out of this situation. I'm looking forward to milk at 32 cents in the litre, which is good. This will enable me to deal with my arrears, get my farm back on its feet, and pay down I'll start paying my mortgage in full and then paying down the arrears. And he felt that was reasonable. So in that case, were short-term difficulties actually related to a BSE outbreak on the farm that had driven him into arrears. In other cases, we obviously came across like quite a lot of people who'd worked in construction and needed to retrain to get new jobs. But in many cases, that was reasonable, as you can see from the second quotation there from an interviewee from Cork. When we conducted the research, which I said was 8 months ago, it was very striking, though, that people who had mortgages that were unviable, that mortgages they could never pay down, at the time had no pathway out of arrears. Okay, so these are two quotations just to illustrate to you their situation. This interviewee from Cork said, "I want to work, but at the moment the mortgage arrears is getting bigger and there's no point in finding work and they throw us out of the house. I can't sell my house, even if I wasn't in negative equity, because if I would make myself homeless and so the state wouldn't give me a house. He wouldn't qualify for a council house. So I have to wait until they start proceedings to throw us out. Then there's almost 100,000 of negative equity, which means they'll be pursuing me for the 100,000, but I still have no house, no job, no nothing." So that was the legal situation at the time. I was also struck by the fact that quite a few of the people we interviewed who had what their MABS money advisors considered unsustainable mortgages, mortgages that never pay off, actually were very keen to move out of their home. Some of them for psychological reasons, like this client from Tralee I quote here, who just said every time they came into the house it reminded them of their situation. Other people needed to move for practical reasons. They wanted to move for work within Ireland. They wanted to emigrate, but they couldn't leave. So finally, I'm sure most people here are aware that earlier in the week the government published the heads of a new personal insolvency bill. So I just wanted to make some comments on, based on the research, the extent to which the Personal Insolvency Bill is a solution. So the Personal Insolvency Bill makes provision for a number of solutions to this issue of over-indebtedness. Debt release certificates for people with unsecured debts of less than €20,000 who don't have assets. What's called debt settlement arrangements for unsecured debt of more than €20 who do have assets, like homeowners. That's repaid over 5 years. Personal insolvency arrangements for both secured and unsecured debt of between 20,000 and 3 million, which is repaid over 6 to 7 years, and then the remainder is written off. And then there's also reforms to the judicial bankruptcy regime, which allow for automatic discharge after bankruptcy for 3 years, but you may be required to pay, continue servicing your debts for another 5 years. So those reforms are quite radical changes in the Irish context. It used to be minimum 12 years for judicial bankruptcy discharge, for instance. But they are not a generous solution in the international context. So those of you who are interested, the Law Reform Commission published a very useful report on this issue in 2010, where it lists all the bankruptcy and debt write-down arrangements in other countries. And these are not generous compared to, for instance, the period for discharge of unsecured debts in other countries such as Germany. What is significant and unusual and relatively generous in the international context is the personal insolvency arrangements. So the arrangements that people can write down some of their mortgage debt and remain in their home. Also, which I think hasn't come out in the public debate about this, is certainly the debt relief certificates, the debt settlement arrangements, they are just formalising what's happening on an informal basis between banks and lenders all the time. So formalising that is very valuable because informal deals lead to inconsistent deals, and also they'll require licensed debt negotiators to negotiate these agreements, and there are issues at the moment of lots of people, private debt negotiators, setting themselves up which are unlicensed, unregulated. A lot of them are former mortgage brokers. So to me, that's a big improvement. I also think the potential for write-down of debt while people remaining in the family home is very useful. There's been a lot of public debate about this and about the indirect implications, the costs for the state, which obviously has recapitalised these banks. But there's been very little discussion of what are the direct costs for the state if we have this level of repossession of family homes, and the vast majority of these people will be rehoused in rent supplement accommodation, which obviously has a significant cost for the state. So certainly for people with children in homes that reflect, you know, family homes that reflect their needs, the write down of some of their mortgage debt and allowing them to remain in the home will be a cheaper cost for the state, certainly in my view. Thank you.
Right, okay. I'm going to talk about the prospects for the Irish property market, which is a question that I'm often asked. I thought it was time that I had a kind of a more comprehensive answer than some of the ones I've been giving to date. So I'm going to run through a series of six factors that I think are going to shape the market both now and in the coming years, and I'm just going to work my way through them. So the first one, of course, is that the market is still unwinding and has been unwinding, obviously, for the last 4 years. So the graph on the top left is the property price index constructed by the CSO. And just the summary text at the bottom there is what accompanies that in their report. So house prices in Dublin are down 52%, apartments in Dublin are down 58%,
from 2007, property prices in general are Dublin down 54%, in the country they're down 46%, and so on. The two maps, as Rona's alluded to, is some of the work we've been doing with DAFT in terms of trying to make sense of the 1.3 million records. We've mapped those in at a much finer grain than county level into about 1,000 areas. The map in the middle is average asking price, where the blue is low and the red is high for a three-bedroom house. And the map on the right is the drop in price between 2006 and 2011. And the dark red areas there are areas that are more than 60% drop in price. The blue areas are still more than 35-40% drop in price. And we're still unwinding, and it looks like we'll be unwinding for a while. So these are some of the projections that Nama Winelake has pulled together during his on his blog, and there's a whole series more of these where different analysts have kind of predicted where we think we're going to go to. Most kind of seem to be talking around 60%. And given that Dublin apartments are nearing off at 60%, it seems reasonable that most other things probably will unwind to about that level. Now, the question is how long is that unwinding going to continue for? And again, the jury's out on that. Some people are suggesting the end of this year, some people are suggesting next year, and some people are even suggesting the year beyond that. So until this unwinding occurs, clearly the prospects for any kind of stabilisation or growth in the market is weak. Now, if we think about oversupply, which has obviously been a very contentious issue in some of the media debates, this is the 2011 prelim results from the census for overall vacancy. So this is not oversupply, this is vacancy including holiday homes and second homes. There are 294,000 vacant units that are considered to be habitable. This does not include derelicts or obsoletes. These are habitable units. On a typical housing model where you'd look at 6% base vacancy, taking out the holiday homes and second homes, we're probably looking at an oversupply of around 80 to 100,000. The 6% base vacancy, given the age of the housing stock, I'd consider to be a generous base vacancy rate. Vacancy rate in the UK and so on is around 3.2, Netherlands 3.4, and so on. There are 10 counties where the vacancy rate is above 20%, so the colours on this map are the dark blue are above 25% vacancy, and it kind of works its way down. So the green is 10 to 15%, the cream is 5 to 10%. Every county in the country is running above 7.8%. The lowest is Dublin, 7.8%. Or South Dublin, I think, is about 4.4%, but Dublin as a whole is around 7%. If we look at one particular group within that, is obviously the unfinished estates. So unfinished estates are a component of some of the vacancy issues. And if we look at the numbers through the Department of Environment household survey, there are the numbers are 2010 and 2011 are the split here. So it went up slightly in 2011 in terms of the number of estates, 2,876, and that's principally because they were catching estates they'd missed the first time round on the survey. The number of units in those are 122,000. There's planning permission for another 59,000. The number occupied is relatively high. It's 85,000 that are occupied. So in the 2011 data, 36,000 of them are either unoccupied or under construction. So there was a drop between 2010 and 2011. The number of units that are complete and vacant are around 18,500, and then there's about another 17,500 that are in some form of construction. And the map there just shows where they are, and they're literally in every single local authority in the country. If we have a look at what happened in that data, though, between 2010 and 2011, and obviously the spreadsheet is up on the department's website, and it provides the data for every single estate, so you can do some analysis on it. 105 of those estates actually had a fall in the level of occupancy. 1,536 of them, just over 50%, had no change in the level of occupancy, so exactly the same number of units occupied in each year. Another 573 had a change of 1 to 2 units, and another 287 estates had a change between 3 and 5 units. So In summary then, the vast majority of estates actually had very little change in the level of occupancy between the 2 years. And in fact, the top 100 estates accounted for over 60% of the change. So there were some estates that actually had very, very large changes. There was one estate that had over 400 units occupied during the year. And that's principally an estate that had started, the units had been sold off, the plans in 2006, 2007, the development was stored, it then completed and people could move into the apartments they'd actually bought a few years ago. These were not sales that occurred during 2010, 2011, they occurred previously. So it'll be interesting to see whether how the level of occupancy changes now from 2011 into 2012, given the rate of activity of development in those estates. So of the there's about 701 estates that are actually complete in development terms. They have issues of vacancy. There's 109 that are in the database that haven't really been started. There's 244 sites that are active, where there is development work occurring, and there's 1,822 estates where there is no activity at all. So there are incomplete units, or there's development work that needs to happen on the estate, but there is no activity by the developer, principally due to lack of finance and so on. And the level of activity has fallen during the year by 43%. Housing, of course, is not the only issue if we're going to look at the wider property market. And in many ways, housing has taken the focus away from some of the issues in the commercial sector, which in some ways are larger. So office vacancy for Dublin, which is probably the only area we have relatively detailed information, is in excess of 20%. Around 800,000 square metres of empty office space in and around the city. If you want that in context, that's about 250 Liberty Halls of empty office space. It's a large amount. And these are some of the data from Savills and the Centre for Urban Regional Studies from Trinity. These are the vacancy rates up until the end of 2009 for the centre of Dublin. And you can see there for Dublin 4, the vacancy rate is nearly 25%. And rising, and the vacancy rate for Dublin 2 is 15% and rising. The only area really that's holding its own is the IFSC. This is more worrying in some ways. This is the office space around the edge of the city, so the northern suburbs, the western suburbs, the outer southern suburbs, and Blackrock, Dunleavy, Rath Down. And you can see the northern suburbs there, very steep rise in vacancy rates, approaching 50%. At the end of 2009. Okay, so this is industry data in conjunction with Trinity. Similar kinds of issues in relation to hotels, where you know the Bacon Report, in conjunction with the Hotel Federation, suggests that around 15,000 rooms, too many oversupply hotel rooms, about 26%. We don't have very good data at all around retail in the public domain. So we know from CB Richard Ellis's research that retail space, in terms of retail park and shopping mall, so not all retail space, but the big box retail and shopping mall space, doubled between 2005 and 2010, went from around a million and a half square metres up to over 3 million square metres. What we do know is between 2005 and 2010, consumption didn't double. Okay. Consumption went down. Okay. We do know from, if you go around any of the towns in Ireland, there is a lot of empty retail space. One of the real gaps that we have really in the data at the moment is we have very poor public data on commercial property, and we don't really know what's going on in that sector. We have some information now around housing, and it's getting better. We really don't know what's going on beyond commercial, beyond what the property sector itself is collecting in data and is releasing. And obviously land has been significantly reduced in price, typically anywhere between 75% and well over 90%. In terms of where the demand might come in the future, my feeling is that the new demand is going to be weak. And this is partly because although the population is growing through natural increase, the rate is presently low. So the CSO figures for 2010 and 11 show an increase in population through migration, natural increase in deaths and so on, around 11,500 in 2010 and 13,500 in 2011. And the principal growth between 2006 and 2011 during the censuses is actually newborn children, the 363,000 children born in that period. And as my next point makes, they're not going to be buying homes for 20, 25 years. So you can't take the fact that there's been a population increase between those two periods as indicative that that will translate into house sales. It's of small children, okay? And household formation group, typically aged between 20 and 40, are the group that's migrating. So the graph at the bottom is the group that's showing that. So the net immigration for the last 2 years have been 34,000 in both years. 34,500, 34,000 have been leaving the country. So 70,000 people have left the country, principally of the group 20 to 40. Now, some would argue, well, this might be offset by household fragmentation, and clearly the shrinkage in household size has been an important part of the demand for housing. And we've seen household size shrink from 3.34 in 1991. It's probably around 2.6, 2.62 for 2011. The issues around this at the minute, though, is that whenever we have an economic recession, a household fragmentation is affected by economic circumstance and tends to lessen. So children are more likely to stay at home, and from working in the university, I'm acutely aware that there are a lot more students who are staying at home and commuting than are living in a property in and around the university. Parents are less likely to separate for economic reasons. They simply can't afford to separate and sell the house at negative equity loss. And young adults are more likely to share property than to look to own their own property. So that kind of household fragmentation or the shrinkage in household size is likely to dampen, because clearly those three things are choices and not necessarily a compulsion. And until the economy recovers and it becomes viable for households to fragment, then that process will weaken. If we look at the existing pool, so people who already own property and their ability to be able to function in the housing market, that's clearly been much reduced, partly as Michelle has already illustrated. So the data from the central bank at the end of last year is showing that one in three households are in the state. One in three households with a mortgage, so they're kind of the 700,000-800,000 people who have mortgages, are in negative equity. And about 50% of investor buy-to-let properties are in negative equity. So whether owners want to trade up or down or move to another part of the country or to disinvest, they're locked into their present property unless they weren't prepared to realise a loss. So they're effectively lost to the market. Obviously, this significantly reduces the pool of potential traders until the price rises sufficiently that they can trade. And that might be quite a long time, depending on where you were in the market and how long the fall-off was and how long it takes to rise back up. You know, if the house prices come down 60% and you were at the 10% bit and you've got the 50% gap, so if house prices drop 60%, and then rise at 5% a year, which would probably be probably just above inflation, probably wouldn't be a bad rise. It'd take 19 years to get back up to where they were. Okay, so you're off the top somewhere you bought in 2007. It takes a long time for you to get back out of negative equity and you to come back into the market unless you're prepared to realize a loss or to take that loss with you or to trade up or down or whatever it is. So that's going to restrict the recovery market really to first-time buyers and those not in negative equity to some degree until the market rises to catch these back out again. Clearly, there's an issue around mortgage arrears, as Michelle's already kind of been through. Might well be joined by investors who are on interest-only payments. If the banks start to move to ask people to start paying down the capital, there might well be a whole bunch of people who own 2, 3, 4, 5 properties suddenly become have difficulties. Clearly, we know there's a number of properties that have more than one loan secured against them, and so there is the potential for distressed assets to come onto the market, which would obviously keep prices low. Just in the terms of the general context, clearly the housing market and the property market in general works in the context of the overall economy, and the Irish economy has been severely weakened over the past 4 years. Household income and access to credit is much reduced. And the austerity measures in terms of various tax increases and deductions are biting into people's personal finance. And people have had radical changes in their financial circumstances through unemployment, presently running at about 4.3%, and underemployment in its various forms. So the live register is around 440,000 at the minute. We clearly have an unstable Europe at the minute and a general weak global economy, and that will have a deadening effect. And the banks are reluctant to lend for mortgage credit. And even if a household did want to purchase a property, their own reserves are depleted and their access to credit restricted. And that's really not likely to change until the wider international and national economy recovers and the banks have worked through their corrections. And finally, just go through confidence and caution. Clearly, the confidence in the property market is at an all-time low. The crash in the prices, negative equity, mortgage arrears, issues around unfinished estates, the uncertainty over NAMA and how that's going to shape the market, construction issues around things like pyrite problems, probably around 20,000 plus houses have problems with pyrite. Clearly, there have been issues around Priory Hall, and that's considered to be the tip of an iceberg in terms of some poor construction around property that was built during the boom. It's just undermined the faith in the housing market as an investment and also in terms of for buying for a home. And I think confidence probably is set to remain weak in the future, and that buyers will proceed with caution in the future for all of those reasons that I've kind of cited above. And if growth, when it occurs, if it does, is more likely to be kind of marginal and hesitant, perhaps after a short dead cat bounce, where people are waiting until it gets to the bottom. They don't want to get caught on a rising market. Everybody piles in, it goes up, all of that pool is gone, and we're back to weak demand again, and the prices slide back down again, which is a typical kind of pattern that's happened in other housing crashes. So, conclusions. My personal view is that the Irish property market, the prospects for it are presently quite weak. I'd like to be providing an upbeat, positive assessment, but the evidence for me just doesn't support that case. The property crash aligned with weak domestic and international economy is severe, and clearly that shadows over the property market. When it does recover, it will recover in the cities first, but it's going to take a long time to recover in some places, simply just due to the huge issues of oversupply in some parts of the country. The priority, I think, is to tighten up supply and demand, so really to hold back on any future house building in the short term, get supply and demand into a line where households are competing for property. That will stabilise things and start to get some growth. If we start to go before that, my sense is it will just flatline the market because we'll maintain too much supply in relation to demand. The other thing that I think is really needed is on the kind of the data and the modelling front. We need good commercial data about the commercial property market. We need robust housing planning models using demographic and labour market data at fine spatial scales as the foundations to revise development plans before we embark on any new major house building programme. So, we need to understand what's going on in terms of our demographics and our labour market, and we need to align up our development plans and how we want to develop the housing market together. We can't have kind of ad hoc, laissez-faire planning, come-as-you-like kinds of developments in the future.
It only remains for me to thank our speakers very much, and thank you very much.